It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, billionaire conservative political activist David Koch passed away today. We'll talk about the impact Koch and his brother had on American politics nationwide and here in Wisconsin. First, on this week's edition of Food Friday, we're talking about salads. You know, in theory, it's that pile of green stuff you put on your plate so you can eat, you know, less healthy food without feeling guilty. But salads can be a lot more than that, including fully fledged meals in their own right. Jeannie Kelly is a cookbook author, food writer, and food stylist. She's written a number of cookbooks, including Salad for Dinner, Complete Meals for All Seasons. Jeannie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, does the salad get kind of like, an understudy role? We think of it as the thing we eat before the real food or in a little corner of the plate alongside the real stuff?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I'm such a salad fanatic. I like to think of it as the star of the show. But that said, I'm not opposed to a lovely, you know, opening salad to start a meal.
Let's talk about the basics. What are some of the greens you like to use, maybe especially this time of year, as the base for a meal type salad?
Well, I'm a fan of arugula. I eat a lot of it. I grow it, and it's so easy to grow that I just kind of keep it planted over and over and over again. So definitely that's one of my favorites. I love spinach. A nice, delicate baby spinach is a great green. If I want crunch, you know, there's always, you know, you can't go wrong with a little bit of romaine.
Now, I feel like I'm an okay cook, Jeannie, but I'm weirdly bad at making salads. I always feel like they're boring. I don't know. Did I rinse the salad not enough, too much? Did it dry out enough? Should it be colder? Is there like a secret to just having the greens taste really good and fresh?
I do. I have noticed. I am, as I said, a little bit spoiled by growing a lot of my greens. And so I notice every once in a while when I'm working or I'm out on a job somewhere and someone opens a bag of greens, they don't have the same flavor. And it's just, they're just not as intense. So I think that if you can find a way to source your greens at a farmer's market, or even sometimes in the, some supermarkets have those bulk bins where the greens are prettier. They just seem fresher than the ones that are in the bags. I know the bags are so convenient. There's just nothing easier than just opening a bag and dumping some dressing on it. But I think it's worth the extra effort of really sourcing better salad greens.
Is there something you like to use? Now, here in Wisconsin, we have, winter, and the fresh stuff isn't yes. going to happen. What do you go to when the fresh stuff, it's just not realistic unless we build like a hydroponic yurt in the backyard?
Well, you know, there are certain cold weather greens that are delicious. Like radicchio is one of those ones that can go through the season. And even, you know, at most markets, you can get things like Swiss chard, collard greens, cabbage. Cabbage is a lovely salad green because you slice it really thinly and it just adds that wonderful flavorful crunch. Broccoli, if you take the stems of broccoli and you know, take all the hard, rough edges off and finely slice that inside, that's a lovely crunchy green too. So, you know, there are definitely good options to be had in the winter. I think when it comes to salad, you just have to sort of, you know, expand what you think of as salad greens, because, you know, even a shaved zucchini can be used as a salad green. You know, there's so many options.
Okay. Yeah. That's stuff we can work with even when it's not fresh. That sounds great. Now, say we want to take it and make it a main course salad. What kind of things do we do to give it, you know, a little oomph, a little heft that's going to make it a full meal?
Well, you definitely need to think about protein. You know, I think a lot of people are concerned about getting enough protein in their diets if they're only eating a salad. So there are easy ways to add protein. Vegetarian sources could be a can of chickpeas. You know, I think you guys know a lot about chickpeas there. You've been talking about them.
We just did last week. Yeah.
Yes. Or another favorite of mine, cannellini beans. They're very like plump and meaty. They have a creamy texture. That's a great way. Leftover roast chicken makes a great thing to shred and add to your salad. Cheese is always great. Feta is one of my all-time favorites. blue cheese adds a little protein, nuts. I mean, there are so many things. And then, of course, grains. Sometimes I'll do something where I'll cook some farro, which are wheat berries. And I'll cook those in a little salted water and maybe add a little bit of vinegar to the water and drain that off at the beginning of the week and then toss it with a little olive oil. And I can stick that in the refrigerator and I can just add a little handful of that to whatever salad I'm making throughout the week. And it just, it adds that sort of fortification. It makes it just bulkier. So, I mean, there are so many options.
Talking to Jeannie Kelly, cookbook author. Her books include Salad for Dinner, Complete Meals for All Seasons. We are making salad the center of the plate and the star of the show right now. Jeannie, it's partly a story about combining flavors, but it seems like with salads, the texture is important. How do we make sure we have a good range of textures that work together?
Well, it depends on what kind of salad you want, but I think for most people, they would tell you that they are looking for a certain element of crunch. And so we talked about nuts adding a good, you know, sense of bulk to it, but they also add great crunch. Like a toasted almond is great to add. You can add walnuts. I mean, basically any nut will go into your salad. Something that I've been using a lot lately, which I've been enjoying that adds a little crunch and flavor, are sunflower seeds. When I have good quality bread at home and there's just like a little nub at the end and you're never quite sure what to do with that, I always cut that into cubes. I toss it with a little olive oil. I put it in my toaster oven and then I have this nice bag of croutons that I can use later in the week because that adds a really crisp effect. And you can even add celery to provide crunch for our salads, and romaine is crunch. Fennel, raw fennel, or some people call it sweet anise. That adds a wonderful slight licorice-y flavor and good texture to salad as well. You want your salad to be moist. Nobody wants a dry salad, but you have to be careful that you don't have your salad. You never want it to seem oily or overdressed. So I always recommend just making a dressing, add a little bit, and then add a little bit more, or very, very lightly dress your salad. And then you can serve dressing in a bowl, you know, alongside in case people like more, because I think that can definitely kill a salad if it gets all oily and sloppy.
Now, you shared a couple of recipes with us. We have them online, by the way, at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's dig into one of them now. Roasted balsamic chicken and green bean salad with goat cheese. That sounds, I love the name. Talk us through how this one comes together.
Yes. Well, this one I think is great for late summer because a lot of people have green beans in their gardens. It's seasonal. The arugula, even a bag of the baby arugula is delicious. That's how much of an arugula fan I am. and so that makes it easy. And then cherry tomatoes. Cherry tomatoes are always delicious. So what's really convenient about this recipe is you marinate boneless, skinless chicken thighs. What could be easier in like a nice, it's almost like similar to the ingredients of the vinaigrette. It's olive oil, garlic, balsamic vinegar. And you marinate that and then you put it on a big roasting pan and you roast it at high heat in your oven until the chicken is really succulent and done and delicious. And you take that off and on that same pan, you don't even wash it, you add your trimmed green beans. And then you roast the green beans in all those delicious juices from the chicken and the balsamic vinegar, and they get sort of coated and glazed and just tender. And then that gets mixed with the cherry tomatoes, a little bit of arugula, and then the whole thing gets goat cheese on the top. And it's a really spectacular salad. And I think you could serve that to people who might claim not to feel that salad is main course worthy, and they would that salad would change their mind.
We're talking to Jeannie Kelly, food writer and stylist, author of the cookbook Salad for Dinner, Complete Meals for All Seasons. We are making salads our main course today, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you make a meal with salad? Do you win friends with salad? Is this a common dinner in your household? What do you like to put into it? What do you put in to bulk it up? Maybe the proteins or some grains? Do you have a question for our guest about how to turn that salad into a full meal? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find some recipes from Jeannie at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about how to make a meal out of a salad. Jeannie Kelly is with us. She's written cookbooks, including Salad for Dinner, Complete Meals for All Seasons. You can join us in our Food Friday conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite salad? That is the salad and the main course all rolled into one. What is the secret for you to a great salad? Or do you have a question for Jeannie? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Kathy is with us in Caledonia. Kathy, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. Maybe I missed it, but I've been listening to you. I love to add hard-boiled eggs to my salad, sliced or diced. Did you mention that?
Kathy, thanks. Jeannie, you mentioned some proteins. I don't know if eggs were on that list. Are eggs a good solid addition, though?
Absolutely. I can't believe I neglected to say hard-boiled eggs. You are so right. Hard-boiled eggs are wonderful. They're a great source of protein. They're delicious. They make so many salads so good. So I'm so glad you reminded me. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call, Kathy. Is there anything that eggs play really well with in salads?
Oh, gosh, so many things. You know, I tend not to want eggs in salads that might have a fruit component in them. For some reason, it just doesn't mix. So I like them better, the super savory things. Like, they're great. One of the salads that you have the recipe for is a salad niçoise, and that prominently features hard-boiled eggs. There's another salad in my book called The Green Goddess, and it has hard-boiled eggs in it. And green beans and green tomatoes and green lettuce and a green goddess dressings and that sort of creamy herbaceous thing with the eggs is delicious, you know, as is something like, you know, olives, capers, all those things to me go really well with the hard-boiled eggs.
Sounds great. We'll go back to our callers. Abby is with us in Spooner. Abby, hi.
Hi.
Hi. What did you want to bring up, Abby?
Salad. In a pasta bowl, you put a chicken breast on the grill and corn on the cob on the grill. After those are grilled, you chop the chicken breast up, you slice the corn off the cob, you throw it in a bowl, chop tomatoes, pearl mozzarella, and then you make a little dressing with balsamic vinaigrette, a little bit of olive oil, salt and pepper, and I add a little bit of honey to that, and then you toss it all together and put it in a pasta bowl with a slice of multigrain bread and a glass of wine, and
Wow. You're
good to go.
That sounds great, Abby. I just wanted to ask one thing. Pearl mozzarella?
Yeah, you can get fresh mozzarella in little pearl balls the size of
maybe a
nickel, and you toss in a handful of those.
That sounds great, Abby. That's wonderful. And Jeannie, I did diss my own salad-making ability. I will asterisk that. When I make grilled chicken and put it on a salad, it usually comes out pretty good.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a great thing. And going back to Abby, on the perlini, that little tiny mozzarella balls, mm-hmm. I like to mix that with the orecchietti pasta. And the orecchietti pasta are those little ear-shaped.
Okay.
And so it's so cute. You know, they collect that. They hold that. They're the perfect size to hold that pearl of mozzarella. And that salad sounded wonderful, too. I wonder, you know, since you have the chicken in there, you could try maybe one time not putting the mozzarella in there. And then along with that grilled corn and the grilled chicken, like in the summertime, to have a diced peach in there. It just would be so delicious and summery. I think that would be a good addition to that delicious sounding salad.
What is this taking this too far? Could I grill that peach?
Yes, that would be great. You just would want to be careful that you had it on a very hot temperature so that you got a little bit of that nice grilled flavor without making the texture sort of soft, because you wouldn't want it to fall apart and get mushy in your salad.
Thanks so much for that call at 800-642-1234. It's Food Friday. We're talking to Jeannie Kelly, cookbook author, author of Salad for Dinner. We are making salads our main course today. We've got a few recipes from Jeannie up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Back to your calls. Duke is with us in Milwaukee. Duke, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What do you got for us, Duke?
Well, I make a very simple salad. A couple leaves of iceberg lettuce, some cherry tomatoes, leftover rare steak cubed, and then I will toss that in olive oil and balsamic vinegar and top it off with some feta. That's a meal.
Yeah, easy to put together. Duke, thank you so much for that call. He's got a little steak on there, Jeannie.
Yes, I am a fan of a steak salad. I make one that's very similar to what Duke makes, but I put blue cheese instead of the feta cheese. Mm-hmm. And I usually use a slightly heartier, maybe more flavorful salad green than the iceberg, but I totally understand that people love iceberg because it's so cold and crunchy. And then sometimes I even like to put like a little roasted new potato with that. There's just something about, you know, you feel like you're at a steakhouse, but you're eating a salad.
Duke, thanks so much for that call. And Jeannie, he mentioned this, the steak he uses, it's leftovers. And I guess, and I've been there, like making soup, sometimes salad can be a great way to use up when you got that little bit of something left over.
Oh, absolutely. Any leftover chicken, as I said, the leftover bread, odds and ends of, you know, vegetables. You know, sometimes you open your refrigerator drawer and you have maybe one carrot. And you have one zucchini and, you know, one cucumber, and, you know, you can find a little bit of lentil, or you can find a can of chickpeas or pasta or farro or something and cook that up, add maybe the leftover chicken. Maybe you have a nub here or two of some delicious cheese. I mean, it really is quite astounding, the deliciousness that you can come up with some random leftovers when you're putting it together under a vinaigrette or some sort of salad dressing.
Let's bring on another caller now. Travis is on the line in Mercer. Travis, hi. Oh, Travis just dropped. We went to pick him up. He had a question. It looks like, want to know if you should wash and how you should wash lettuce when it comes in the bag. I always wash any lettuce, Jeannie, and I've got like a salad spinner, you know, one of those not as seen on TV type things, but you know, you spin it around to dry it off after you rinse it off. How much do you rinse your greens?
I love my salad spinner. And sometimes what I'll do is I'll fill the salad spinner, you know, with the wet greens, and I'll let them sit for, maybe a half an hour or so. Sometimes I'll do that in the refrigerator, because sometimes I find it can revive the greens if they feel like they're a little wilty. I do recommend washing the greens that come in a bag. I know people hate to hear that because just the convenience quality of being able to open a bag and just dump it in a bowl. But I think it's safer. I think it's food. I think it's better for you. And I think just we all have to be so careful with, you know, the foodborne illnesses. I just always recommend washing it. And if you have a salad spinner, it's so easy. I mean, they're such remarkable devices, you know. I don't know if yours is the kind where you spin it on the top or
you just like push the thing down and it just, yeah. Okay, it's kind of fun. Yeah.
Yeah, it is fun.
I wanted to check out, Jeannie, one more salad that you shared with us. We've talked about the roasted balsamic chicken and green bean. You mentioned the salad niçoise. Brown rice grape leaf salad is the other one we've got up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Tell us about that one.
Oh, this is a great salad. So I love, you know, the dolmas, Greek grape leaf appetizer dish. And I don't know if you or your reader, your listeners have ever made grape leaves, but it's pretty time consuming. But, and so this is a way where you can have all the wonderful flavors of grape leaves, but it's in a salad because you essentially take the grape leaves, which are grape leaves that have been pickled in a brine, and you chop those up and you mix them into the salad. Now, you can get the grape leaves at most Middle Eastern markets or Greek markets. If for some reason you can't find them, chopped capers will mimic that kind of salty green texture really well. So don't panic if you can't get the grape leaves.
So it ends up being like a deconstructed dolma, those grape leaf roll-up things.
Exactly. That's exactly what this salad is. And I like to serve it with a nice little dollop of yogurt and a few greens. And it was interesting because a lot of people, like earlier, you talked about side salad and a main dish salad. And what I really love about this brown rice salad is it does have pistachios in it. It has the fetas in it. It has currants. It's enough for a vegetarian to make a meal out of it, especially with the little dollop of Greek yogurt on the side. But this would also be something that you could serve at a dinner party, you know, when you were entertaining guests that ate some things and not other things. So if you had a little bit of grilled lamb or a little bit of grilled chicken, this is a wonderful dish that can be served on its own as a main course, or it would be a really, really nice accompaniment to a little bit of grilled chicken, fish, or lamb.
All right, Jeannie, weekends are coming. Do you have a salad plan in the works?
Well, I feel like I've been living off of Greek salads lately. I think there was one day last week where I had for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Wow.
And I learned about last year that traditional Greek salads, when you have them in Greece, don't have lettuce in them. So it's just the feta, the red onion, cucumber, tomato, and olives. So we have lots of cucumbers and tomatoes in the garden right now. So I've been making that. And there's just, for me, there's something about the quality of that kind of acidy vinaigrette with a little bit of garlic and dried oregano in it that mixes with the feta and the olives, and I have that with a piece of bread, and I'm happy.
All right. Well, enjoy that this weekend, Jeannie, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, and I hope everybody makes a delicious salad this weekend as well.
That's Jeannie Kelly, food writer, food stylist, author of cookbooks, including Salad for Dinner, Complete Meals for All Seasons. She joined us on Food Friday to expand our salad horizons. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, cars and power plants aren't the only things putting carbon into the atmosphere. Quite a bit has come from the dirt in our farm fields over the last two centuries. We'll talk to a soil expert about how new farming practices could help fight climate change and help crops in the process. First, billionaire conservative activist David Koch died today at the age of 79. He, along with his brother Charles, are best known for putting millions of dollars into libertarian political causes. Many point to the Koch's influence at the center of the rise of the Tea Party and conservative Republican politics nationwide. Their investment also had a big impact here in Wisconsin. Our next guest is here to talk about David Koch and his influence in the political world. Eleanor Powell is the Booth Fowler Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Eleanor, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Can you talk about David Koch and his brother Charles and the political causes they put their time, money, and effort into?
Sure. Well, David and his brother Charles collectively are some of the most influential actors in American history in many ways, certainly the most influential non-elected actors. They've contributed, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to a variety of political causes, ranging from direct contributions to political candidates or helping to elect different, lots of sort of libertarian-leaning candidates. But they also give a lot of money to sort of policy advocacy groups. They've established an incredibly influential group, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, that helps to disseminate, conservative legislation across state legislatures around the country.
How can we start to evaluate the influence, the directions they've pulled American politics into?
Well, it's really incredibly wide-ranging from the congressional level to the state legislative level across a bunch of different policy issues. So everything ranging from trying to reduce regulation, trying to reduce taxes, particularly in terms of loosening environmental regulations, tightening voter ID laws, helping to weaken labor unions in Wisconsin in particular, among other places. So again, they've sort of tried to influence policy in a bunch of different directions across a bunch of different stages, both national and local.
One of the big stories in American politics over the last decade was the rise of the Tea Party back in 2008 to 2010-ish. How much did the Koch brothers and the groups they funded play into that?
They played a tremendous role. You know, officially, they weren't funding, sort of, it wasn't any sort of one Tea Party group. The Tea Party was sort of a loose network of sort of affiliated groups. But their big donor group, the Americans for Prosperity, backed candidates for in Republican primaries that were strongly affiliated with the Tea Party. And so they were sort of part of the leading efforts to elect a whole generation of Republican candidates, including here in Wisconsin. Former Governor Walker was one of their sort of biggest beneficiaries.
Talking to Eleanor Powell from UW-Madison, looking at the influence of David and Charles Koch. David Koch passed away earlier today. Let's talk more about Wisconsin in particular. How much did David Koch, along with his brother Charles, leave a fingerprint on politics here in the state?
You know, they really tried to influence policy in state legislatures around the country, but Wisconsin was one of their particular targets and one of their most successful targets. I mean, they backed Governor Walker. They helped him win his recall efforts. They even tried to support him in his presidential run in 2016, which they were unsuccessful on. But, you know, they tried to sort of influence policy both in terms of who was elected in Wisconsin, but also what policies passed the state legislature. And they were largely successful.
Now, with Charles Koch, he seemed to play more of a behind-the-scenes role. David Koch did things like run for vice president on the Libertarian Party ticket. I think he and his running mate got about a million votes nationwide. What did you see about his slightly more out-there role in politics than just the funding side of things?
You know, he was often the sort of more public face of their efforts. You know, again, what you mentioned in 1980, he actually ran against Reagan on the Libertarian ticket. And, you know, as you said, we have won about a million tickets for his VP race that year. But he, you know, in addition to his political advocacy, he also was somewhat differentiated himself from his brother, but with a lot of philanthropy in terms of the arts. He was a big contributor to the ballet. He also was a huge donor to cancer research. He was also a big dinosaur enthusiast and gave, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to natural history museums in both New York and D.C.
His politics usually lined up with the Republican Party, but there were conflicts, including more recently over issues like immigration. The Koch brothers taking a more libertarian stance, open to immigration versus the movement that ultimately brought Donald Trump into the presidency. What do you make of those tensions?
Well, both David and Charles, you know, had strong disagreements with President Trump on a number of issues. They, you know, backed a different candidate in 2016, and they've, you know, had strong policy issues, differences, you know, since President Trump was elected. You know, David was also, again, consistent with his more libertarian views, pro-choice. He was, you know, pro-same-sex marriage, and so there are sort of notable policy differences. It's not clear that they were sort of thrilled of this more recent direction that the party has taken, and they've, you know, made it clear that they weren't necessarily going to help with President Trump's reelection, although it's very clear they're planning to spend hundreds of millions of dollars in 2020 helping to elect Republican or libertarian-leaning Republicans that they support.
Some of the early analysis of the legacy of David Koch and the Koch brothers has focused on the issue of climate change. A lot of their efforts were involved in either denying the existence of climate change or opposing efforts to ameliorate it. How big an effect did they have when it came to how the U.S. deals with climate change issues?
Well, they were pretty effective in helping to either roll back climate change legislation or environmental protections that had passed, and certainly putting the brakes on, you know, enacting any new legislation. in those areas. You know, they've made it very clear that they wouldn't support Republican candidates that adopted those positions. And, you know, that is now the sort of orthodoxy in the Republican Party.
How do you stack the Koch brothers up against other famous or maybe less well-known big-time donors in American politics?
Well, the scope and scale of their donations are really just on a completely different playing field from even the, some of the most active donors on either the left or the right. They, you know, together, not just the two of them themselves, but they've created a sort of larger donor network of like-minded contributors, and they have these semi-annual summits that bring these donors together, get everybody on the same page. And one of the things that they've been most effective at doing is sort of translating the money that they spend into influence. There are lots of big-time donors that try to do this, that have these aspirations, but are much less effective. They don't, they're not good at targeting their campaign contributions or targeting sort of how they get things done. The Koch brothers, with a handful of exceptions where causes didn't pan out, have generally been much more effective.
Some people have pointed toward more local levels, city levels, for example, where the Koch brothers helped oppose things like public transportation. So they weren't just focusing on federal, even the state levels, but also local government sometimes.
No, and this is one of the reasons why they've been most effective, is they sort of managed to channel their influence. They realized that their dollars would get them a lot further at the sort of local level or the state level than they would at the presidential level. And, you know, they were, they've been sort of less, much less successful at electing their preferred presidential candidates. And, you know, we've even talked about sort of bowing out of presidential elections going forward and choosing to channel their influence much more locally.
Some people have tried to untangle, okay, how much of this is David and Charles Koch have this firmly held libertarian ideology versus how much are they doing things like opposing regulation to help their own business interests? Is it possible to sort that out? Does it matter ultimately?
It's not clear that it matters, and it is extremely difficult to sort out. You know, the Koch industries, you know, have their hands in a bunch of different pies. They're big into sort of oil and natural gas refining, chemical refining, but they also have lots of other smaller companies, you know, Dixie cups and Brawny paper towels and you name it, the Koch industries probably have some relationship to it. It's certainly true that their opposition to environmental regulation was almost certainly in their, you know, personal financial or corporate self-interest. And so disentangling the sort of cause and effect there of what motivated those policies is difficult to sort out, and I certainly wouldn't want to speculate on their motives, but there certainly was no conflict there.
Now, sometimes a business owner, if they're attached to, say, a retail brand, an easily boycottable retail brand, might be a little more shy about being so upfront in politics. Why didn't this hold a company like Koch Industries and the Koch brothers back?
Well, it is interesting. I mean, they have been slightly more concerned about their corporate reputation in the last few years. I've undertaken advertising campaigns trying to improve the reputation of their activities. I mean, technically, a lot of their political activities and sort of contributions are actually funneled through various nonprofit organizations that don't actually have to disclose their donors. So there's been a lot of work by investigative journalists, by political scientists, and others to actually try to piece together what the total political influence is. They typically contribute in ways that are, you know, fly under the radar, but because they've just, the scope and scale of their donations has been so massive, they've actually garnered a lot of attention and subsequent investigation.
Eleanor, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Eleanor Powell, the Booth Fowler Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She joined us today to talk about the death of conservative billionaire political activist David Koch and the impact he and his brother Charles have had on American politics. Coming up, we'll find out how the soil we use in farming can be part of the solution to climate change. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the city of Green Bay is requiring developers to set aside money to make public art if their projects are getting tax assistance. We'll find out more during our state news roundup. Now, when we think about ways to combat climate change, vehicles or power plants that burn fossil fuels might come to mind. But another part of the solution might be under our feet in the soil we use for farming. Our next guest has studied soil and agriculture for years and says that by making some changes, we can keep more carbon in the ground and make farms more productive and profitable in the process. David Montgomery is professor of Earth and Space Sciences at the University of Washington. He's the author of several books, including Growing a Revolution, Bringing Our Soil Back to Life. David, thanks for joining us today.
Sure, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, as we drive around looking at farmland in Wisconsin, we may not notice a lot of changes over the years, but you've written extensively on the degradation of our soil quality around the world. What kind of changes are we seeing?
Yeah, you know, I'm a geologist, so I'm trained to think about things that happen a little slower than most people notice. But if you look at the back history of agricultural societies around the world, there's really a legacy of land degradation that really comes to the fore in places like Syria and Libya today, where we don't think of them as agricultural powerhouses. But if you go back to Roman times, you know, a couple thousand years ago, there's good tax records of high harvests of wheat off land where the soil's been so degraded now that they have real trouble supporting themselves. And so I wrote about that in a book called Dirt, the Erosion of Civilizations. It's the first book I wrote about soil, looking at the problem of land degradation around the world. And there's really two aspects to it. We've eroded topsoil, you know, physically lost it due to accelerated erosion, the removal of soil. And we've also degraded soil organic matter. And organic matter is half carbon. And so we've degraded soil carbon stocks historically as well. And that's had an impact not only on the fertility of the land, but it's also had an impact on the amount of carbon in the atmosphere.
Let's do that first part first. As we erode our soil and lose carbon in our soil, what does that mean when we're trying to grow crops in that soil?
If you look at our sort of modern understanding of what makes for soil fertility, there's sort of three really big areas. There's the physics and the chemistry of the soil, you know, the kind of rocks that were broken down to make the soil, the elements that are within it, how water moves through it. But the other part that we almost forgot in the 20th century is the biology of the soil, the microbes, the bacteria and the fungi. And there's organisms in the soil, much like there's organisms in the human gut that we've heard so much about in the last couple of years, that really help in the soil. Plants acquire mineral nutrients. They're involved in the supporting the defensive system of plants. And really the parallels between what goes on in the gut and the root system of plants are pretty astounding. And so carbon is essentially the currency that drives the what I like to call the original underground economy, all that life in the soil that's breaking down the organic matter, getting mineral elements out of the soil and helping getting them into plants. And why would this life in the soil do that? Because those plants, by producing the organic matter, are making the food that drives the microbes. And so there's symbioses, sort of virtuous circles, if you will, where the life in the soil promotes the health and growth of plants, which then through their senescence and decay, when they inevitably die, as all things do, it helps feed the organisms back in the soil and keeps the circle going.
Now let's talk about carbon capture and climate change. A lot of us just think about burning fossil fuels. That's driving the changing carbon composition in our atmosphere. How does soil get into the picture?
Well, you know, if you look back at the sort of how much carbon people have put into the atmosphere over our whole agricultural history, it was only fairly recently that fossil fuels overtook the degradation of soil carbon as a big source of CO2 to the atmosphere. And there's a study done back in 1980 by a guy named Menzies Stiver, a gentleman in my department at the University of Washington, who looked at how much of the carbon that had been added to the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution didn't come out of a tailpipe or a factory, but came from plowing up fertile agricultural soil and accelerating the decay of that organic matter, which liberates carbon back to the atmosphere. And what he found was roughly a third of the carbon that had been added to the atmosphere up to about 1980 was from plowing up the Great Plains, plowing up Eastern Europe from agricultural impacts that degraded soil fertility through the loss of soil organic matter. So it's a potentially a pretty big reservoir. The amount of carbon in the world's soils is twice the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. Now, there's a lot of soil in the world, right? And we don't farm all of it. But there's actually potential to put some of that carbon back out of the sky and down into our agricultural soils if we change the way that we farm.
Talking to David Montgomery from the University of Washington. His books include Growing a Revolution, Bringing Our Soil Back to Life. We're talking about agriculture, soil, the food we eat, and climate change. David, let's get into that point now. We can do things differently in a large enough scale to make a difference?
I was pretty impressed when I was doing the research for Growing a Revolution, not only at how much carbon could be put back into agricultural soils, but that it could be done with changes to agricultural practices that were actually more profitable for the farmers. And that's where I started to turn into a real optimist on this issue. Now, you can, I could describe what those practices are. There's sort of a recipe for doing that that I found had worked on farms all around the world in terms of guiding principles for agricultural practices. And they involve not tilling, so doing no-till, but minimally disturbing the soil, keeping the land covered with covered crops. There's always a plant with a living root growing at any one time, whether it's in between one's cash crops or in some of the subsistence farms I visited in Africa, where you have multiple crops all growing at the same time in sort of a polyculture. And then the third thing is growing a diversity of plants, which actually helps support that microbial life in the soil that helps support the plant life. And with that combination of things doing, minimal disturbance, the cover crops, and the diversity of crops, it feeds the life in the soil and allows farmers, through restoring their organic matter and rebuilding the fertility of their land, to reduce their reliance on nitrogen fertilizers, to reduce their need for pesticides, and to reduce the amount of tractor trips across the field. If you're not plowing, you're basically not burning as much diesel. And it didn't take that many years, just a couple in most cases, to start the trajectory of soil restoration back to the point where yields came back and recovered to where they were before the transition, and the farming were much more profitable because they were harvesting as much but spending less to actually do it. And that's a recipe not only for a more profitable farm, but for putting carbon back in the ground. And you know, the estimates that you can find in the published literature for how much carbon we could put back into the world's agricultural soils, they're pretty variable. They range from a low of sort of 5 to 10% of our current fossil fuel emissions up to, you know, high, more than 50%. In Growing a Revolution, I tried to look at those kind of estimates, and I came up with thinking that, well, you know, 10 to 20% might be a pretty reasonable estimate globally. So putting reforming farming practices to rebuild the health and fertility of our land is not going to solve the atmospheric carbon problem, but it's a really good down payment on doing so that pays dividends in terms of healthier soils, so less agrochemical use, less off-site farm pollution, higher profitability for particularly for small-scale farms. And there's also questions about whether that would actually lead to growing food that is more nutritious for us when we eat it. And that's the subject of the book that my wife and I are working on now, that hopefully will be done in a year or two. Got a lot of research and work to do on that to try and put the story together.
David, as we wrap up, you mentioned that you've visited a lot of farms that are doing these soil sustainable practices. Is this happening at a large scale, though? Are you seeing huge commodity farms take on some of the practices you mentioned to where it's a scale that we're really going to see a big difference?
Yeah, and that's a great question. That's one of the things that also helped make me optimistic about it is I visited farms in the Dakotas, for example. There were 20,000 acres that had adopted these principles. The ideas behind the minimal disturbance, cover crops, and the diversity of crops, they're scalable. They're the practices that you would use on a really large, industrial commoditized commodity farm are different than the practices you would use, say, on a small-scale vegetable farm growing for an urban farmer's market. You know, the specifics you would use on those farms are really different. The technology, the equipment, all that would be different. But the guiding principles were the same and very effective. And that's where I think that the real promise lies in trying to engage the wonderful curiosity and creativity of our farmers for how they could work these principles into their kinds of practices. So, for example, one commodity farm that I visited in Ohio specialized in growing corn, soybeans, and wheat with the three cash crops that were grown. But they got the diversity and the cover crops in between those rotations. So it actually had restored the organic matter content in the soil there to higher than it was in the native forest before farming ever started in that region. There's a wonderful potential for rebuilding the health and fertility of our land on both organic and conventional farms. The principles work in either context, small scales to large farms. It's sort of a different philosophical way to look at the premise underlying farming practices, but it really requires the engagement and ingenuity and creativity of farmers in different regions to figure out how to apply those principles to their particular crops and setting and technology. So it's an exciting time. We haven't figured out all the answers, but there's an awful lot of potential benefits.
Thanks to David Montgomery for joining us. He's a professor of Earth and Space Sciences at the University of Washington. His books include Growing a Revolution, Bringing Our Soil Back to Life. He talked with us about how changing the way we manage our farm soil, tilling less and keeping more carbon in the ground, for example, could help our crops, help our farms be more productive, and be one step in combating climate change. If you're already doing this, if you're a farmer who's using, say, no-till or low-till methods of farming, love to hear from you. How's it working for you? Email ideas@WPR.org. Some pumpkin spice in the news over the last couple of weeks. Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts are bringing back their pumpkin spice coffees earlier than usual. Spam, the canned meat, they're going to have a pumpkin spice flavor, apparently. Weird. Usually, I would talk to producer Chris Molina about these things, but today is his last day. So instead, we'll do a little tribute to Chris Molina. You may have heard him at this point in the show, often with me talking about weird foods in the news. You may have heard him filling in for me a couple of times. What you haven't heard is all the work he's done behind the scenes on various shows over the years. He's been with us for a bunch of years, working in our technology department on the Joy Cardine show. It's Central Time, of course. That's the biggie for me. He was one of our founding producers here on the show. He's been a fill-in producer all over the place. He's a jack of all trades in a lot of ways. He's made a lot of great contributions to the show. I know Chris isn't actually listening right now. He's out at a celebration or a mournabration, I guess, since he's going on. But he's going on to another great job here in Wisconsin. So, Chris, if you come back and listen to this later, thank you so much for all the great work you've done with us over the years and all the bizarre inside audio jokes we've had as well. So, tribute to Chris Molina here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.